नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। We're reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 11, and we'll chant text 9, and we'll read up through to text 12. Navayam manyamananam Atmanam tatra sadhanam Girova sadhu sochanam Grinimo marmatadanaha. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. You demigods think that your own selves are the cause of your attaining fame and victory. Because of your ignorance, saintly persons feel sorry for you. Therefore, although your words afflict the heart, we do not accept them. Please repeat after me. You demigods. Text 10. Shisuka uvacha it. I'll just chant myself. It yakshipya vipum viro naracher viramardanaha akarma puner abhanad akshaper ahatam punaha. Shukadev Goswami said, after thus rebuking Indra, king of heaven, with sharp words, Bali Maharaj, who could subdue any other hero, drew back to his ear the arrows known as Narachas and attacked Indra with those arrows. Then he again chastised Indra with strong words. Text 11. Evam nirakrito devo vairina tatyavadina namrishyatad adhikshepam totrahata iva dvipaha. Since Maharaj Bali's rebukes were truthful, King Indra did not at all become sorry. Just as an elephant beaten by its driver's rod does not become agitated. And text 12. Praharat kulisam tasma amogham paramardanaha sayano nyapatad bhumau chinapaksha ivachalaha. When Indra, the defeater of enemies, released his infallible thunderbolt scepter at Bali Maharaj with a desire to kill him, Bali Maharaj indeed fell to the ground with his airplane, like a mountain with its wings cut off. And purport by Srila Prabhupada. In many descriptions in Vedic literature, it is found that the mountains also fly in the sky with wings. When such mountains are dead, they fall to the ground where they stay as very large dead bodies. Praharat kulisam tasma amogham paramardanaha sayano nyapatad bhumau chinapaksha ivachalaha. When Indra, the defeater of enemies, released his infallible thunderbolt scepter at Bali Maharaj with a desire to kill him, Bali Maharaj indeed fell to the ground with his airplane like a mountain with its wings cut off. And before I begin to speak, I would like to just express my honor to speak here. And I always feel a little uncomfortable sitting on the seat in front of all you, because I genuinely feel you're all my superiors. But as it's the etiquette to honor Srila Vyasadeva by placing the speaker on the seat, I'll accept it. But begging you for your blessings. When I was asked to speak this morning, I was shown this verse in purport. I said, this is a difficult purport because it's very short, and the subject matter. I don't know about any of you, but personally, I can't remember ever witnessing a mountain fly. And in some ways, though, this verse is very appropriate, because today we honor Lord Varaha. And here's another subject that also requires great faith when we think about it, right? That there's this boar that is some incredibly huge size. It's born from the nose of a four-headed creator, and then, you know, fights battles and goes down and picks up the earth and brings it up. If, you know, the world goes through changes, the different paradigms that that people can accept. And for the last couple hundred years or so, placing faith in this kind of description is considered to be naive. Actually, there's a term, it's called naive realism, they call it. Right? Now, there are people who will say, you know, your books are very good. Your Ramayana and your Mahabharata and your Puranas, there's a great wealth of wisdom to be found there. But these stories are not true. To accept that would be foolish or childish. But you can derive great benefit from the messages that are there. Like here, there's an interesting message going on. There's something going on between Bali and Indra. And there's some wisdom being spoken, you know, about, you know, Bali Maharaj has criticized Indra about his jubilation and how that's foolish. And he gives a good explanation for it. And says that Indra, hearing it, he understood that actually what he's saying is true. So he didn't become upset. He thought, I can't complain because there's some truth. And the truth is a beautiful thing, and people become attracted to it, and people can have the ability to derive some truth and some important message from these. And ultimately, it's that message that's very important. It's that message that can change our lives. So sometimes I ask myself, so then why do we have to have the rest of it there? Why do we have to have this description of this boar? Or why do we have to hear this, that these mountains fly? And Prabhupada then just continues in this purport. He could have tried to avoid the subject, but Prabhupada just said, no, it's true. There are descriptions in these mountains. They die and they fall to the ground. And the only reason that I can come up with, besides the fact that if it's true, accept it, is that for us to transform ourselves from the condition that we're in now, from the illusion or the bondage that we're in now, it requires a change of heart, in a sense. And when I say change of heart, that also means like a paradigm shift in the mind. We have to be able to accept that there's a lot happening that we don't know about, that's beyond us. You know, among my many faults, one of my greatest faults is that I always think I'm right. And I've had my friends tell me this. They tell me, you can't ever admit that you're wrong. You always think that you're right. And this is a problem that you have. And it's true. And many of us may have that problem. And so to hear something like this, we will rationalize it in our mind, explain it away. But perhaps we actually have to have a shift to really begin to perceive the truth. And I can tell one story. Maybe some of you have heard this story. I believe it's in the Lilamrita, but it involves my Guru Maharaj, Tamal Krishna Goswami. And it happened at a time in Los Angeles in the early days of ISKCON. And really the first kind of real temple that ISKCON had was in Los Angeles. Before that, it was just these simple little storefronts. You know, storefront? Do they call it a storefront here? Just a little shop. But this was the first real temple was in Los Angeles. And my Guru Maharaj was a very expert manager, so he took up a lot of responsibility there. But one day he was sitting with Srila Prabhupada alone in his room, and he was complaining about so many different things. Different devotees were doing this wrong and that wrong, and there's this problem and that problem, and he was going on and on. And then Srila Prabhupada wanted to change his perspective. So he pointed to a painting that was actually the cover of the first canto of the Bhagavatam, which you should all know, with the different Vaikuntha planets. And then within that, there's the material world. And he began to describe what that painting was. And he said, take a look at this painting. He said, there's this vast expanse of space, the Vaikunthas, that go beyond anything that we can conceive of. There are literally innumerable When we say innumerable, it means there's no number that, we don't have a number that goes that high. Planets there. And each of those planets has innumerable people there. And in some little corner of that vast sky, we find the material world. And Lord Vishnu lays down in that material world, in the ocean. And from his pores come universes. Right? We can't count how many universes are coming from his pores. And when he exhales, they all come out. When he inhales, they return. They, you know, there's this destruction. They return back in. He exhales again. They come out. And within one of those universes, one of those innumerable universes, there's this planet Earth, which is just one amongst unlimited planets within that universe. And on that planet Earth, there are so many places and so many innumerable living entities. And there's one small, tiny place on that planet called Los Angeles. And within Los Angeles, there's this very tiny, tiny place, this Hare Krishna temple. And within that temple, even, there's so many people living. But there's also one Tamal Krishna, and he's thinking that he's very important. And he said when he heard that, it really affected him. It was a paradigm shift. You know, that we're running around thinking that we're so important. But actually, if any of us disappeared tomorrow, the world would just keep going on without us somehow. And so it's important for us to sometimes think this way. I remember I used to distribute books telling that story. Sometimes I distribute the Bhagavatam and I tell this story about it. And people would find it very interesting. And they would purchase books just based on that. But if we're so small and insignificant, which is certainly a fact, then we should be able to accept that there's so much beyond us that we may not be able to perceive or understand. And if we can come to that place, then we can begin to understand the truth. And if we can't come there, we can never understand it. And Srila Prabhupada shared a story. It's one that probably most of you have heard before, but I'll share it again because I feel it's important. That Narada Muni was on his way to the Vaikunthas to see Lord Narayan. Daily he would go to see him. And it said that on his way he saw two people. First he saw a brahmana, very pukka brahmana, learned. You know, and Prabhupada said he's taking his three baths a day very nicely and all the rituals. He's got it all very nicely, performing them all very nicely. And he sees Narada Muni, you know, pranams. And where are you going, Narada? I'm going to Vaikunthas to see Lord Narayan. Oh, could you please do me a favor and ask a question? Could you ask him, when will I get moksha and return to him? He says, I'll ask him. I'll come back and I'll tell you. Thank you very much. And as Narada continues on, he sees a very simple cobbler who's sitting underneath the tree and working on shoes. And he's very happy to see Narada, offers his pranams. He asks, where are you going? Narada says, I'm going to the Vaikunthas to see Lord Narayan. Could you do me a favor? Yes. Can you ask Lord Narayan when you see him, can you ask him when I will also receive moksha and return to him? I'll ask him. Okay, thank you very much. And so Narada goes and he sees Lord Narayan. And before he leaves, he asks these questions. He says, on my way here, I saw two people, one brahmana and one cobbler, and they both asked me the same question. When will they return to you? And Lord Narayan said, the cobbler will return to me at the end of this life. But the brahmana, actually, it may take him many, I don't know how long it will take him. It may take him many lives. And Narada said, really? It seemed that the brahmana was so fixed in all his sadhana and everything. I'm surprised to hear this. And then Narayan said, well, if you want to understand, you can understand like this. Ask them one question. You ask them, or when they ask you, what was I doing? You say that I was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. He said, okay. So the Lord returns to this world, or Narada returns to this world, and he sees the brahmana, and he says, oh yes, I asked him, I can tell you. And he said, yes, when will I return to him? And he said, he didn't know. He said, it might be many lifetimes. And he said, really? But I'm doing everything just right. And he said, what was he doing when you saw him? And he said, the Lord was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. And this Brahmana said, oh, yeah, right. So he thought maybe he probably didn't even see him. And then Narada saw the cobbler, and the cobbler was happy to see Narada. He said, did you get the answer to the question? And he said, yes. He said that you'll return at the end of this life. And he was very happy to hear that. And he said, "What? Tell me, Narada, what was my Lord doing when you saw him? He was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. And he said, oh, this is wonderful. He was just so happy to hear it. And Narada asked him, you find that easy to believe? You don't find that, unusual? And he said, and I don't find it difficult to believe at all. He said, you see this banyan tree that I'm sitting under? Within this banyan tree, there's so many fruits, and they just fall to the ground all the time. And when each fruit, there are thousands of seeds. Right? And within each seed, another banyan tree is sitting inside there. So if he can put an entire banyan tree in each tiny, tiny little seed, then why should I believe it's difficult for him to put an elephant through the eye of a needle? So this is a very interesting answer, actually. And if you think about this answer and really contemplate it, then what we find is that that actually there are like miracles happening all around us all the time. And one just has to have the eyes to see it. But to have those eyes, you need to change your paradigm. To become truly objective, right? And actually this is kind of the empiricist or the scientist or the people that would deem someone a naive realist for accepting this story about mountains or about Lord Varaha. They would say that what they are, they're truly objective. They're just looking at the facts. They look at the evidence and they make a decision based on the evidence. But the fact is, to be truly objective, it begins when you accept that anything is possible. Because the fact is, if you're truly objective, you have to accept that my perception is limited. And if you accept that my perception is limited, then you have to accept that there are other things happening outside my perspective that I'm completely unaware of. And it could be anything. And once you come to that point where you say anything is possible, then you're truly objective, and not until you come to that point. It should be a simple thing to understand. But it's a very difficult thing for many people to understand. The fact is that everyone is placing their faith somewhere. Right? Now, we accept that the Upanishads tell us, Parashya Shaktir Vividaiva Shuryate, that Krishna has these potencies, multifarious potencies that are supporting everything. So we say, if this one person can support everything that's happening, right? He's supporting the planets that are floating in the sky, right? Something's supporting them. So if he can do that, then what is so hard to believe that this mountain can be flying? Right? Something is making it happen. Right? We can ask a simple question, like, why does the heart keep beating? It goes on and on and on and on. Right? We don't know what makes it beat, and nobody can explain what makes it beat empirically. Right? It just continues. In a sense, it's a miracle. Something supporting it. And Prabhupada would actually point to so many kind of miracles that are going on. One example he gave is the coconut. Right? Like, if it's a hot day and we want to have something nice to drink, there's these coconuts, and you just simply have to cut them open, and there's this nice coconut water inside. Now, that is something special, because if you put a can of Coca-Cola on top of the coconut tree and let it sit out there baking in the sun all day, it won't be very nice when you drink it. But that coconut water, it's sitting inside a shell that provides this insulation. Right? So it can sit there for a very long time and be preserved in there. And it's, in a sense, it's protected from the heat or the different elements that would ruin it. But not only that, you think back further. How did the water get there in the first place? Right? Somehow that water came and, fell from the sky. Right? And it was floating in this cloud. And I know I've heard Radha Swami speak about these clouds. I'm sure he's probably spoken about it here, that even the cloud is quite a great miracle, because all the water that is in the cloud, how much does it weigh? You can't measure. I mean, tons and tons and tons of water is floating in this cloud, but it's just so light and fluffy and floating up there, right? And then it falls to the ground, and when it falls to the ground, when things fall on the ground, they get dirty and contaminated. But then it seeps into the ground. And somehow between being pulled through that ground and being pulled up the stalk of the tree, that water gets filtered. But not only does it get filtered, it also draws in all kinds of nutrients that are sitting in the ground. And those are the nutrients that sustain us. So the water comes down from this miracle cloud, hits the ground, and then, now Prabhupada would say, where's the pump and where's the pipe? Say, so what is the pump that's making that water come through the ground and go up to the top of the tree and enter into the coconut? Where's the pump? There's just these roots that go into the ground and they just suck it right in. How does it happen? Nobody can answer that for us. It's a miracle. And like this, there are miracles everywhere. Every little flower on this garland is a miracle when you think about it, that it grows out of the ground with beauty, color, fragrance. Sometimes the flowers have food in them, nuts or something that we can cook and eat. You know, if you went to a child and you said, where do you get your food? They might say, well, I get it from the refrigerator or it's in the cupboard, right? And if you said that it was coming from somewhere else, they could say, prove it. You know, I know, I go right into the refrigerator and there it is. So I don't want to hear your fantasy about it coming from somewhere else. But they could be completely unaware of how it grows. What to speak of, just the fact that, you know, they probably have parents that go out and work to earn a living and then they go to a market and they purchase it and place it there. They're completely unaware of what's beyond their perception. In a sense, it's very childish. It's not a mature way to obtain knowledge. So the empiricists, it seems that in one sense, they are very intelligent. But in another sense, their intelligence is like that of a child, right? In the Brahma Samhita, it says, Pantastu koti satavatsara sampragamyo, that they can go on and on like this for millions of years and never even come to the tip of the toe of Lord Krishna, Lord Govinda. Right? And they'll come up with explanations to explain away the things that don't fit into their paradigm. Right? It's very interesting to think about how such intelligent people can accept things that in one sense are so fantastic. Because they'll say the same thing about us. They'll say, you seem like a relatively intelligent person. Even I can appreciate the value in your books. There's some nice lessons there. But to accept this is so, it's like a child. It's like a story. How can you accept this? But actually, they're also doing the same thing. Their theories, if you really take them back to, you know, the final point, they're just as fantastic. They say that coconut just happened by chance. We look at it and say, come on, isn't it obvious that there's something behind this, someone behind this, some intelligence behind this? And they say, no, there was an explosion and everything just landed just right. And we say, come on, we see that everywhere when we look and we see, you know, perfect balance and design and function, that there's intelligence behind it. And they say, no, it just happened over a very, very long period of time. And that's supposed to explain it. And even if you look at that, time is relative. What's slow for one person is fast for another person. It makes no difference. But everyone is placing their faith somewhere. Right? And we place that faith based on the conditioning of the mind. Our mind can accept some things, and it can't accept other things. Our mind is actually our facility through which we perceive the world and through which we engage with the world. Right? So every one of us, we have senses. We have eyes and ears and so on, through which we take in information. And then that information goes to the mind. And the mind is a very fascinating subject. That mind, what it does is it takes the image. Like if I look at the painting right here of one of the gopis. So my eyes aren't really what see it. My eyes take in the image, but then that image is sent to the mind. And the mind deals with that image. It says, have you seen anything like this before? And then it goes through almost like a search engine on the computer. It starts to search. Have you seen anything like this? Yes. It's a human being. And the human being has got a certain shape and wearing certain clothes. And I know women wear those clothes. Right? So this is an image of a woman. And then I might go further, like, actually, I understand more that you're in this Krishna temple, so maybe that is one of the gopis. And like this, it goes, and then it says, oh, it's a gopi. Right? Now, if I had never seen a gopi before, or didn't know anything about gopis, then it wouldn't have gone that far. And then if someone told me about it, then that would get registered within the mind, and the next time I saw it, it would be able to process that information more quickly and accurately. And so with that information being stored in the mind, there's also, the mind has another kind of, impulsive kind of reaction, right? The mind is like the manas, you could say, is the impulsive part of the citta. So it not only does it store the information and categorize the information, but it also has an emotional response to the information. It either makes us happy or makes us upset. We're either attracted to it or repulsed from it. But why does that happen? This is an important question. Why does one person look at it and say, oh, this is very nice, another person looks and says, I don't like that at all. Right? And it's with everything, right? Like, say, food. Now, there's some places in the world where people find it a delicacy to eat insects, right? There's actually a few places in the world like this. When they see an insect sitting on their plate, their mind, their eyes see it. The information goes to the mind. The mind says, that's an insect. Very nice. Delicious. I want to eat that. Whereas people in other parts of the world, their eyes see that, and they say, what is it doing on the plate? How did it get there? And they'll think, this is the last possible thing I would ever want to eat. I'd rather eat my shoe than eat that insect. Please take it away from me. Now, is it that their taste buds are different? It's not that. It's that the mind has been impressed in a way that it says that is not nice. And the other person's mind has been impressed in a way that says that is nice. And in one sense, the same person, if he would have been brought up in that place of the world, very likely his mind would have been shaped in the way to think, yes, that's very nice, that's a delicacy. So the mind is very malleable. It's being changed at every moment by every piece of sense information that gets drawn in. It's shaping it, it's molding it into a different shape. And based on that, we have our likes and dislikes. Right? And based on that, we find truth either here or there. We place our faith either here or there. Right? So if our mind is conditioned in such a way, if it's conditioned with humility, like the cobbler, if a person has been around people that have humility and seen the benefit of it and developed a love for those people throughout their life, then naturally their mind gets conditioned with humility. And they begin to act with humility. And they begin to see with humility. The mind gets shaped with humility. And for them, they can accept, oh, certainly it's possible for the Lord to take the form of a boar and to pick up the earth with its snout. And for another person whose mind has been shaped in a different way, perhaps the mind's been shaped in a way to accept that there's no one greater than you, right? Perhaps from their childhood they've been told this, they've been shown this. And they've seen religious thought kind of mocked, made fun of. Then the mind gets shaped with that. And in a sense it creates a filter that anything that doesn't fit into that paradigm gets filtered out. They won't accept it. There's maybe you've all seen the magazine Origins magazine that was produced by Sariputta Prabhu and Jhutakarma Prabhu. I don't know if you've seen this. A magazine about science. And they told a joke in that magazine. And the joke went like this. It said that one man comes upon another man and who's crawling on the ground. And he says, "Oh, why are you crawling on the ground?" He said, "Oh, I lost my keys." And he said, "Oh, you lost your keys here?" He's out in the street. And he said, "No, I lost them over there." He said, "Well, then why are you looking here?" He said, "Because the light is better here." Right? So obviously, it makes more sense to look where you drop the keys. But it's only within the light that he can perceive things. So he's saying, if it exists, it exists within my perception, so it must be within this area where the light is. It's foolish. Right? But if our mind is conditioned in that way, then we'll filter everything out. The reason why they told that story, it was in relation to the idea of evolution. Because the strongest evidence that's there for evolution is the fossil record. They say they've dug all the fossils out of the ground and they tell a story. If you go this far down, you find these kind of bones. And if you go farther still, you find more primitive bones. And if you go back further and further and you dig down deeper and deeper, you'll find the bones of like prehistoric man. And each level is there in the different levels of the earth. So there's the evidence. And if you're truly objective, you'll accept the evidence. It's all right there. But the point that they made was, if you're truly objective, you'll see that there's been all kinds of evidence. Sometimes they're finding bones of modern man very, very deep down. So how do you explain that? And what they said, their research showed that when that would happen, that the scientists would say there's been some mistake. And they filter it out. There's been some mistake here, so we're not going to consider this. And when there was something that fit into their paradigm, then they would accept it, even if the standard of that evidence was less. Right? Now, why do they do that? You could say, one, it's just cheating, straight out cheating. They know the truth, but they're hiding it. And that's possible. Another possibility is that their mind has been shaped in such a way that they're just incapable of accepting that truth. And so they find a way to say that that must not be true, like that. And in this way, the mind becomes actually our facility for either understanding what is true or what is false by the way that it's been shaped. Now, we say that our process is meant to purify the mind, right? That through hearing, the mind can become changed. Basically, the theory of all the different schools of yoga, or you could say the schools of all the different schools of Indian philosophy, is that we are bound. We've been conditioned by the gunas. And that the goal of this life is to actually escape that conditioning and attain moksha, to attain some kind of liberation. And there are different ideas of exactly what that liberation is, and there are different ideas of how it's attained. Like, for instance, Patanjali, his idea was that this mind has been shaped in a particular way and is preventing you from experiencing your true self. And it's running, it's constantly moving from one thing to another, always. When you're awake, when you're asleep, dreaming, that mind just doesn't stop. And if you can stop it for a second, then you can experience the true self, the Atma. And when you experience in the self, because the nature of the Atma is Brahman, it's exhilarating and it's true and it's beautiful and it's wonderful, and that's the system that they practice. And our system is similar but different. Right? We also agree that the mind is running and running and running like this, and that it's been shaped in different ways, and that is causing our suffering. But we also believe that that mind, rather than stop the mind, you can actually reshape that mind until it reflects the self. So when the self looks at the mind, it sees a reflection of its own true nature. Right? It's like we're traveling through this world like, you know, a submarine, right? These boats that go under the water, and they have what they call a periscope that comes out, and it can look around. In a sense, we're like that. We're this Atma that's sitting within the body. We're 1/10,000th time the tip of a hair in size, it's described. And we have these senses, you know, comes up and we can look out through the eyes. We have this periscope of the eyes that can look, they can see a certain amount. And all our senses are like that. But deep within, there's the self. And it's perceiving everything through the senses, which go through the mind, which go to the self, to the Atma. And it's the Atma's looking. And generally, the Atma's looking at the mind and thinking that's the self. But that mind's been shaped by so many different things. But if we can shape the mind so that it reflects itself, then when we look at the mind, we'll see the self. And that's done through Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smarnam Padasevanam. Because the true self is the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna. So if the mind becomes shaped with this idea that I am the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna, through hearing Bhagavatam, through worshipping, you know, the Murti of Krishna, through associating with sadhus, through kirtan and so on. Gradually the effect of that is it's all this morning program, all it's meant to do is it's just meant to shape the mind in such a way that it's reflecting the self, to leave these samskaras, these impressions. And if we continue at it patiently, then the mind gets shaped in such a way that it becomes pure, meaning that it reflects the self. And when one looks at it, then they see the true image of the self, and they experience that ecstasy, that the beauty and the truth, like that. And in that state, actually, you're no longer limited by your senses, and you can actually perceive these things. You can perceive Lord Varaha, you know, coming down and picking up the earth on his snout. And you may try to explain it to others, but they won't understand. They'll think you're crazy. Yeah. You know, there was also from Sariputta Prabhu, he drew this analogy that this world is like a virtual reality. You're all familiar with the term virtual reality? I don't know. That they have these computer programs that they can put the glasses on you and put headphones on you and even give you a glove. And in a sense, the computer program is set up so that even they said they can put you on like a belt that you can walk on. And so as you walk forward, the image makes it look like you're walking closer to something. And the sound, you'll hear the sounds of footsteps going as you walk. And you'll see if you can see birds and you can see this, cars, whatever. And like this, and you can move your hand in that world like that and pick something up, bring it close to your face, move it away from your face. But it's all a computer program. But the point that they made is as the computers get more well-developed, it can become very close to reality. And we see this happening with computer games. They're becoming more and more. When I was a boy, the computer game was ping pong. I don't know if they had this here. But it was just two little white lines and a little ball that would bounce back. And then you'd move yours and it would hit that side. And you move yours and hit that side. And nowadays that seems very, very primitive. Because now it's almost like stepping into a world, you know. And parents are, you know, very concerned about this because it's like their children are stepping into worlds that they might not want them to step into. And if they understand, it's shaping their mind, actually. It's conditioning them in a particular way. If they're engaged in violence in this world, then they understand it could make their mind violent and so on. So the point that Sariputta Prabhu was making was that as the computers get more advanced and you get plugged into that machine, you could feel like you're in that world and you could forget that you're in a computerized virtual reality and you can forget the real reality. And he said that even someone may come into that virtual reality, just like they do in these games. Two people can be playing in the same game and they could come into that virtual reality and tell you, you know what? You're existing in a computer program, but actually there's a reality. If you just take the glasses off, you'd see that. And if the person inside was so convinced that it was true, they'd say, get away from me with your nonsense ideas about this. This is truth. I can see it. I can touch it. I don't want to hear about your nonsense stories about another reality in some other world. Right? It's a fascinating analogy because it's actually what we're experiencing here. That this prakriti is just moving. It's just this computer program, in a sense, this great cosmic computer program. And our minds have become conditioned by it. And the remedy is this sadhana, this hearing, this chanting, that it'll reshape the mind, and it could give us the conviction that there's something beyond this, that may be very fantastic, very difficult to believe because we're not seeing it in this world, but it's the truth. And so through this regular practice, we can come in touch with that truth. And when we come in touch with that truth, we experience true happiness. So I will stop here. I don't know if I've gone over time or if there's time for questions. Is there time for questions? Yes? Raj Bihar Prabhu?
Thank you, Prabhu. Very nice class. The beginning of the class, we were mentioning how that story of the Brahmin and the cobbler, and also about Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj's pastime with Prabhupada. At that time, I had a question in mind. When you made this point that, you know, even the scientists, the modern people, even they are demanding ultimately faith.
Yes.
Like we are saying that we should have faith in Lord Varadev, and even they ultimately talk about Big Bang and things like this, which ultimately calls a big leap of faith.
Yeah.
But we see that as compared to the devotees, the scientists, even though they demand faith, they have given us something tangible, like say the iPods, the computers, the electricity, the aeroplanes.
Yeah.
So they have given us something by which we can put faith in them.
Right.
Whereas the devotees, they talk about fantastic theories. I'm just playing the devil's advocate.
Yeah, no good.
So we talk about the spiritual world, but we don't have anything tangible to give the modern people. So how do we explain this argument?
There are many ways you could approach that, but this is the way that I would personally approach it. And so the fact is, whether it's approaching them or approaching us, you know, in other words, some people won't be convinced no matter what you say. And sometimes it's most important just for our own understanding that, yes, they've given us all these things. We were just talking about this last night in this class. I was speaking and we were discussing. Take the iPod, okay? Now they're about, I think today, they're coming out. Apple is coming out with a new thing. I don't know if you've heard about this. It's the next big thing. It's called the tablet. It's like this computer on a, just like a thin board almost. It's like an iPhone, but it's much bigger and it can do all kinds of special things. And I'm sure it'll be able to do all kinds of wonderful things. But you take the iPod, let's just say. Or take the iPhone. Well, let's take the iPod. iPod, you can put all this music on it. It's amazing, actually, that you can just download it all and you can be walking around with tons and tons and tons of not only information, but like music. And music is such a beautiful and mystical thing. And you have it all right there in your pocket. And you can hear so many different things. And if you consider what life was like, say 200 years ago, to hear music, you had to go find a musician, you know, or do it on your own. And the quality, who could say what the quality was? But now we can get the very best quality musician from all around the world and just have it right in our pocket and carry it around wherever we want. So that is special. And actually, so many devotees have this, and they have their lectures on it, and it's wonderful. You can, but with that gift, actually, there's also like a negative aspect to it. Like when I was growing up, we would listen to the radio to hear the music. Like we all had our favorite musicians. And there would be, on the other end of the radio, there was a DJ, they called it. They called it the same here. And that DJ had enthusiasm for the music that you liked too. And so they were saying, next week, so-and-so is going to be coming out with a new record, and they would have you all excited for it. And then it would finally come out. And before you could even buy the record in the store, he would have that record and he would be talking about it. And they would play the music and then the music would come. And there was something in that experience, something in the interaction between human beings. I love this and you love that. And now we're both excited and we're sharing this thing that was very human and very satisfying, pleasing. And what I feel is that sensitive people are beginning to realize that this iPod is nice, but it's also not so nice. And now I'm sitting all alone in this little world with my little thing, and there's something lost, too. And then when you add up that, and then you have your iPhone, and then you have your television set, and then you have your automobile, and then you buy your groceries, you know, online, and you do all the, you know, at a certain point, you're missing it out on all the human interaction, and the very juice of life is just getting sucked out, you know. So yes, they can offer us so many wonderful things, but what they can't offer us is happiness, because people aren't any happier with that than they were before. But what we can offer is actually happiness. And, you know, and that's why this verse is so important, this Mahajano Yena Katasapanta, because who's better and who's right? You know, ultimately, one person can make one argument, another person can make another argument, and we're all sitting within this this little dark corner without perception going beyond it. So who's right? Well, you look, see who are the Mahajans? Who are the people that who've really embodied good values and live by it and are happy? And whatever they say, that's what we should follow. So we may not be offering gadgets that can stimulate the senses, but what we can offer is like a lifestyle and truth that can actually give one real, genuine happiness. So I think that would be the way that I would approach that question. Are there any other comments or questions? No? All right, again, I want to thank you all very much for allowing me to speak. And Granth Raj, Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.